Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and practiced on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. High Truths is more than a podcast. It's a movement to unite physical, mental, and addiction health. It brings innovations to connect public health, public safety, and prevention. Our discussions inspire people to implement programs that save lives. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a 5-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Drug Free America Foundation, tackling the pervasive issue of substance use and its far-reaching impacts on individuals, families, and community. Drug Free America is supporting ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors and scientists educating on the harms of marijuana. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a burdening conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Burden as in disease burden. Disease burden is the impact of a health problem as measured by financial cost, mortality, morbidity, and other indicators. When it comes to drugs, we are always talking about overdoses and deaths. The CDC predicted deaths in the U.S. for the 12 months preceding March 2024 as over 103,000 people. That's bad. Crazy bad. Yet some people are celebrating because the numbers are coming down. Less deaths is a good thing, I agree, but I'm not celebrating. I remember the good old days when physicians like me were blamed for the opioid epidemic for over-prescribing pain medications. Back then, the public was screaming about 100 deaths a day. Today, we have three times that amount, around 300 deaths a day. Not a celebration. We know that deaths are just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the full toll of the drug crisis. For every death, there is many more with a substance use disorder, as well as a host of medical and mental health conditions associated with drugs. So rather than just looking at overdoses, there are proponents of judging drugs like we do other health problems like injuries or cardiovascular disease. That is, looking at the total disease burden, not just deaths. For example, disability for depression and back pain rated much higher in disease burden compared to diabetes, emphysema, and asthma combined. Yet we know emphysema is more lethal than back pain. To learn more about the burden of disease related to drugs, I reach out to Dr. Von Ries and Connor Cabessi. Dr. Von Ries is director of the Center for Global Tobacco Control and the Tobacco Research Laboratory at the Harvard Chan School of Public Health. He is all things on the harms of tobacco products and alcohol. His academic background is in health psychology, and he trained at the National Drug and Alcohol Research Center in Sydney, Australia. Connor Cabessi is a policy analyst with the Foundations of Drug Policy Solutions and its sister organization, Smart Approaches to Marijuana. He began his career as an intern in the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. So young in his career, and he's already worked on campaigns, served on national and international drug organizations, and co-authored a chapter on the ASAM Principles of Addiction Medicine, 7th edition. He was recognized by the Washington Examiner as an emerging voice in the drug policy field. To learn more about Dr. Von Ries and Connor Cabessi, check out the High Truth show notes. Dr. Von Ries and Connor Cabessi, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you. I should be here.
Thank you.
All right, you both are incredibly accomplished, and even you, Connor, like young in your career, you're still in school. You've accomplished already an incredible amount. It's amazing. Want to get our audience to get to know you a little bit better, and Dr. Ries, let's start with you. You said you studied health psychology. What does that mean? What's health psychology?
Well, really, I've been interested for a long time in the psychological processes that influence health. So, you know, that includes study or understanding of the factors or other influences that shape or inform health outcomes, as well as health behaviors themselves. You know, what are those behaviors that we might do or might try to avoid doing that influences our overall state of health and standard of living.
Does that mean like diet, exercise, compliance with medications?
Of course, those things might all be, topics of research or investigation by a health psychologist. Absolutely.
Yeah. And yeah, we know, I definitely see it as a physician that your attitude really matters when it comes to your health, you know.
Without question, attitude, beliefs, expectations are all factors that we know have important influences on health behavior.
And so you took that health psychology and applied it to tobacco and alcohol. How is, I'm sure that relates very much, but how did you become focused on that, on tobacco?
Well, I think early on in my career, I was particularly interested in drugs and behavior in general, and processes that led to or influenced addictive behaviors. And I was particularly interested in psychological processes, in particular, associative learning, and how that shapes people's drug using behavior through a phenomenon that we now know as cue reactivity. How do people react to cues or triggers that accompany drug use, and how do those cues or triggers serve to promote or prime people to engage in substance use? And as I was working on developing a set of studies as part of my doctoral research, I felt that it was going to be challenging to bring in people who had substance use disorder into the lab to do studies with them. Because of certain ethical issues or the legal status of the drug that they used, and somebody suggested to me, "Well, why don't you work with smokers?" And my first reaction, and this is going back a couple of decades now, my first reaction was, "Well, smokers aren't really that interesting, are they? They're not sort of out there in the streets and engaging in criminal activities and all that. This, some of the things that we sometimes associate some forms of substance use with." But the more I thought about it, the more it made sense. Nicotine dependence does, conform to many of the characteristics or principles of dependence with other substances. And stepping back and thinking about it, tobacco use. We knew then, and it certainly is still true today, tobacco use is attributable with more harm, more death and disease than all other drug categories put together. And so it made perfect sense to start to examine some of my ideas through investigations with smokers or people with nicotine use disorder. And that got me very interested in the phenomenon of tobacco use. And over time, I've sort of moved from the focus on the individual or processes that drive use at an individual level and looking at population level health impacts and policies and programs that we can implement to reduce the overall population level burden of harm associated with tobacco use. But at the same time, through this time, I've been very interested in use of other kinds of substances, including alcohol, cannabis, opioids, and so on.
Yeah, and I'm sure what you've, because tobacco's been around for a while and we've studied it a lot, we could apply a lot of what we learn about addiction as well as prevention and health policy, what we learn from tobacco and apply it to other drugs.
I think that's right. I mean, tobacco is an interesting case because, this is a substance that's been legal through, pretty much throughout the 20th century. At some point in the 20th century, tobacco use was almost ubiquitous. Certainly a majority of American adult males used tobacco, smoked cigarettes. But through the, systematic implementation of evidence-based policies and programs, we've seen the prevalence of tobacco use decline from somewhere in the around 60-70% of adult males. Now we're down at to a historic low of closer to something like 10 or 11%.
Yeah, we made it uncool. It used to be cool, now it's uncool.
Yeah, even while this this drug, this substance is easily accessible and freely available to adults at, almost every convenience store in the country and and supermarkets and gas stations and other outlets. So, you know, despite the fact that it's easily accessible, we've done a good job in changing people's knowledge of the harms associated with tobacco use and changing their social attitudes and expectations around tobacco use. And it's been something of a success story.
Yes.
So there's no reason we couldn't, you know, also think about how we might apply some of those lessons to other drug types, and in particular, the emerging legalized adult recreational cannabis market is one that I think we can apply some lessons from tobacco control.
Yes, I agree with you 100%. There's a lot in all sorts of ways that we could learn from tobacco. Connor, let's turn it up to you. It's interesting, the two of you together, I think you, the mentor and the mentee, and yet both so accomplished. How lucky for you guys to have that relationship too. And I remember in my younger days, I would have loved to have had a podcast of me and Dr. Peter Rosen. How fun is that? But Connor, you're a student. You like political science. You're now a full-time student in public health. Why the focus on drugs?
Prior to COVID, I actually wasn't too familiar with the drug crisis. I knew it was affecting everyone at the local and national levels, but I didn't know about the specifics. But then while I was an undergraduate political science student, COVID then moved my classes online. So I began looking for internships in Washington, D.C. I applied to intern at the White House and was accepted by the Office of National Drug Control Policy, and then joined that team in about August 2020 during the Trump administration.
I just missed you, Connor.
Yep, by a few months.
Yeah.
But then within that team, I was on external and legislative affairs, and then my classes remained online, so I just kept extending the internship through the transition into the Biden administration. I was there for about 1 year, and then after I graduated and finished that, I was like, remain passionate about the issue. I'd learned a lot, so then I moved into the kind of nonprofit sector with an organization called Smart Approaches to Marijuana. And after working there for about 2 years, now I'm in a public health program at Harvard. I took Professor Reese's class on substance use, and at least at school, I'm sort of singularly interested in the drug issue and its related problems.
That's great. Right. And I'm sure you've already accomplished so much, and I'm sure there's a lot more in your future. Are you going to go the PhD route too?
I'm not intending to, but I might apply, but that's not the plan right now.
We'll see. All right, so let's talk about the article that you guys both wrote recently, published in Journal of American Medical Association, JAMA, towards a comprehensive measure of drug attributable harm. Who wants to start and just kind of tell us background of the article, like why was this important to publish and get the word out?
Why don't I jump in quickly and then I'll flip it to Connor. I think I should acknowledge right from the get-go, this was Connor's brainchild. Connor's been sort of, you know, very close to these issues and thinking carefully about drug policy and better metrics, better measures to inform drug policy. And, you know, in other areas of public health, we've seen over the past decade or so, we've seen a move towards generating more incisive measures of the burden of harm associated with various health outcomes that include not just looking at counting deaths, number of deaths, but looking at the number of years across over time in which an individual is impacted by chronic disease. So if you think about it this way, you know, a young person who's impacted by chronic disease, who has that disease, for example, a smoker with emphysema, will have a greater overall burden of harm attributable to tobacco use than somebody, for example, who experiences that illness later in life, you know, and experiences the problem for a shorter or smaller number of years. So it's taking into account both deaths as well as the years in which an individual is impacted by chronic disease, and it covers the full range potentially of chronic illness that is attributable to a particular cause. In the drug era, in the substance use field, you know, I think we've often suffered from a lack of scientific sophistication in the way science is brought to inform substance use interventions or policies. And sometimes we're playing catch up a little bit. And this might be a very good example of something where we have developed, you know, strong public health or population health strategies. But we, in the substance policy field, we are simply continuing to count the number of people who die annually, often just from overdose deaths, and not even from, you know, other causes of death. And this gives us a fairly sort of, you know, narrow view of the overall burden of harm associated with substance use. And it limits our capacity to think about how we might develop or adopt interventions that or policies that might help to prevent other forms of harm that are attributable to substance use beyond, for example, just overdose deaths. So that's the idea behind it. It's not particularly revolutionary, but it's an idea whose time has come, we think, and could be applied with some success to the substance use field to change both the overall, or to better measure the overall burden of harm, and to develop policies that can respond to that.
We have that kind of data when it comes to like high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease, cancer, right? And you're saying we should apply it. I don't know if we have this already to tobacco and alcohol, but you're saying we need it for other drugs as well.
Oh, we certainly, well, we, you know, again, even with alcohol, with tobacco, we tend to count the number of deaths attributable to tobacco without necessarily breaking it out by cause of death or even the number of years in which a person has been impacted by chronic illness. So
that took a lot of historical fighting to get that. I mean, if you look at a medical examiner report right now, you'll see a little box for tobacco. Because for years, people would say, well, this person died of heart disease or of emphysema. Who says this was related to tobacco? Nobody said that until finally it was put in the medical examiner because to put that association. We don't have that association when it comes to marijuana or other drugs. We kind of do for alcohol.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, a limited range of outcomes indeed, yeah, yeah. That's the premise. Connor, I just wonder if you want to jump in and just add to my thoughts here.
Yeah, so the article was premised on what's called the disability-adjusted life year metric, which helps to quantify what Professor Reese was talking about. It's broken into two main components, which measure fatal and non-fatal health loss. And then together, one DALI is the equivalent of 1 year of healthy life. So the first half is for the years of life lost, like due to premature death. So if someone would have otherwise lived until like age 92, but then they died from an overdose at age 30, then they would have lost 62 life years. The benefit of this is that it adjusts for the age at the time of the death. And that's seen if you look at conditions like strokes and Alzheimer's, it's that those account for more deaths than overdoses, but they're mostly among older people who have fewer life years left to live. So when you make that switch, it then helps to demonstrate the burden of drugs because many of those people are younger. The other half is for the years of life lost due to disability when the individual is still alive. That's calculated by multiplying the prevalence of a condition by a disability weight. So if the standard metrics usually look at the prevalence of a condition, and then according to the National Survey on Drug Use and Health in 2023, like just as an example, there were about 19 million cases of cannabis use disorder, but then 6 million cases of opioid use disorder. So just as a crude metric, someone might say the burden of cannabis use disorder is three times greater, but most people intuitively know that opioid use disorder is worse. So then the disability weight helps to adjust for that to then show the non-fatal health loss of opioid use disorder like is greater and more severe. Then together, when you have the years of life lost due to premature death and then disability, when those are added together, that's then the DALI metric. Then DALIs as the sum are then used to quantify the concept of the burden of disease, which is also called the burden of harm. Then just for background on the metric, it's developed by the Global Burden of Disease Study, which is based at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington. It's been around since the early 1990s, and it's been accepted by federal agencies in the U.S., including SAMHSA, the CDC, and the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. And going back to 1999, it was even in the Surgeon General's report on mental health. also used at the state level. California's said it's the most widely used metric for the burden of disease. New Mexico has used it in their reports of health. So the whole premise is that it's an accepted metric. So now we're just saying the field should go a bit further and then incorporate it into their programs and goals to account for additional harms and then to adjust for health loss.
So just to reiterate for our audience, and probably for me too, the old-fashioned way or incomplete way of measuring drug problem is overdoses. But DALI, which is Disability Adjusted Life Years, takes into account the years lost because of drugs and disability because of drugs.
Age when they died, and then for like substance use disorder when they're still alive, basically the severity of the condition.
Okay. Yeah. So the years while disabled because of the disease plus the years lost because of the disease.
Yes.
So, and you're saying California does this and more agencies are using this. Is this something that I can ask my public health department to, hey, can you calculate this for San Diego? Or is this a lot? It sounds complicated.
For the fatal side, I think they would be able to calculate it because they would have the death certificates and then they can just subtract it. For the non-fatal side, that might be a bit more difficult for the local or county level because they would need like better surveillance of all of the conditions. But the Global Burden of Disease study does do estimates for like every state in the U.S. So that's probably as close as you can get, at least now.
Interesting. So how does that show as a number? Like an overdose number, 300 deaths a day, I can understand that. What does a DALI number tell me? Can you give us like a number and tell me how that compares to like, you know, heart disease or depression or back pain or something else?
I don't have them memorized, but I think I normally use strokes as the example. There are about twice as many deaths. But then when you adjust for DALIs, drug overdoses then account for nearly twice as many DALIs.
As twice as many DALIs then?
So there are fewer deaths, but more life years are lost due to them because the people who are dying are younger.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense, right? All right. So how do policymakers use this metric? How does that make a difference to me if I'm making policy using this new metric versus overdose deaths?
Our proposal was to connect it to the White House's National Drug Control Strategy that's produced by the Office of National Drug Control Policy at least once every administration. Currently, the Biden administration's strategy has goals connected to a reduction in overdose deaths and then the prevalence of opioid, cocaine, and methamphetamine use disorder. Our proposal is to, like, it builds on that approach to account for other harms and then to adjust for health loss. And it's actually what Australia's national drug strategy currently does. We're pointing to them, saying the U.S. should take a similar approach. And then beyond drugs, they also have a similar DALI-based goal for tobacco and alcohol.
It provides an overall, more accurate, more realistic appraisal of the burden of substance use at a population level. But it can also give us an opportunity to break it down and look at specific outcomes by specific health or chronic health disorders or diseases. And policies can be tailored then to address those specific outcomes.
Would this then bring marijuana into the conversation, which hasn't been so much in a metrics for Trump or Biden administration? Would this now be able to, like you mentioned, there's so much more cannabis use disorder than opiate use disorder, but that's ignored. Would this metric now apply to these other drugs, or can it still be ignored for cannabis?
Well, it could. I mean, there's potentially, theoretically, it could be applied to cannabis. Absolutely. You know, if we applied the overdose metric to cannabis, well, we would see pretty much no cannabis overdoses, suggesting that it has a very low burden of harm. But there are other outcomes associated with cannabis use that may contribute to chronic disease that should be, as legalized adult markets are being rolled out, we should have a better way to assess the impact of cannabis use at a population health level. So it would be ideal to apply it to cannabis.
So is that something people who are advocating on, you know, the public knowing the harms of cannabis? Should they be advocating for this DALI measure for cannabis and all drugs rather than just overdoses?
One limitation with cannabis is that I'm not sure that we have all of the information we'd like to have ultimately about the health risks of cannabis use. And, you know, there was a National Academies report produced a few years ago that basically said that much of the quality of the evidence on the health risks associated with cannabis use is not very strong. And so we're continuing.
It was a terrible report, even if it was from the National Academy of Science, because it looked at all the possibilities of where cannabis could be helpful and ignored all the harms, which is not medicine. You have to do a fair risk benefit analysis if we're talking about the same report.
I'm not sure we're talking about the same report. It was really focused on the health risks of cannabis use, it wasn't medical marijuana.
I don't think they called it miracle. They looked at all the possibilities where it could be beneficial and ignoring all the studies where it could be harmful.
Oh, that's not the report I'm thinking of. They, you know, were looking at, for example, you know, impact on adolescent health, on, you know, risk of psychosis, on road traffic, fatalities, on, you know, on respiratory health, on cardiovascular health, sort of thing, on cancer risk. I think those are all addressed in the report, but the report was, I think, just a little limited by the lack of high quality evidence on many of those outcomes. But you know, assuming that we will in time generate better quality evidence, that could then be applied to measuring the health risks, or sort of, you know, attributable to cannabis use using the DALI metric.
So Connor, if you were advising ONDCP now and involved in writing the next version of the National Drug Control Strategy, you would put in that the United States use a health burden or DALI method of tracking the disease burden of drug use.
Yes, that is our proposal, with that as the goal and their overarching kind of premise, is then oriented toward reducing the burden of harm attributable to drugs. Then beyond cannabis, opioids, meth, and cocaine, it also, through the measurement from the Global Burden of Disease Study, also accounts for the harm due to drugs for hepatitis C and HIV. So then that harm is also kind of brought into the argument. So right. It lends support to like certain harm reduction interventions, like serum services programs, where people inject using an infected needle and then they contract HIV.
Yeah. But it's more than just hepatitis C and HIV, right? There's all wounds, mental health, homelessness. There's so much more associated with drug use.
You're right. The metric isn't all encompassing. It doesn't account for those outcomes like homelessness. It also doesn't measure crime. And at least through the Global Burden of Disease Study, they don't count traffic fatalities.
What about mental health?
It can. Australia actually does their own National Burden of Disease Study. And then for marijuana, they do connect it to mental health outcomes like anxiety, depression, and schizophrenia.
That's important.
Yeah, it can be used to quantify it.
Interesting. Well, I would add that into the report too, and make those connections. So, Connor, what made me want to reach out is because I saw you on a webinar when the United Nations released their World Drug Report, and you gave a presentation about this. Tell us about your experience and how, like, here you are, this student, and now you're already talking at the United Nations. You know, how that connection was made and what you've learned about other countries and how they measure things.
So that process sort of played out. The JAMA article cited the World Drug Report's use of the DALI metric, and I believe it's been used in every World Drug Report since 2014. So the UN has endorsed it as likely the best measure of health loss. So then every year they release an updated World Drug Report, and then they present it, and they invite two civil society experts to also comment on it. And then they reached out to me to provide a summary of the DALI metric based on the JAMA article. So I did that. And then my employer, Smart Approaches to Marijuana, has consultant status with the UN. So through that link, I was then one of the civil society representatives who was featured.
Well, Connor, you're an amazing young man. How you've managed already to, in your young age, to get to the White House, getting to the United Nations, and you're still a full-time student. That's amazing.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little more about tobacco and alcohol. Again, there's a lot to learn from that. What is the burden of tobacco and alcohol? Do we know that number? If there is a number in the
United States? That's a great question. And yes, I mean those numbers that are available, I don't have them at my fingertips. You know, the statistic that many people who work in the tobacco control field cite, which is the Surgeon General's a numbers quoted from the Surgeon General's report, is about 480,000 people die prematurely from causes attributable to tobacco use. So it's all, you know, running and has been running at about 500,000 people per year in the United States die as a result of their tobacco use. But we could do a better job than just, you know, that's you know, very similar to the point that Connor made earlier, that it's a little bit like counting overdose deaths. And we could break that down by, you know, by disease entity, but we could also look at the number of years that individuals are impacted by chronic illness associated with tobacco use. You know, we know that people die prematurely as a result of tobacco use, but we don't often also describe the fact that often occurs after decades, perhaps, of chronic illness, you know, cardiovascular disease, respiratory disease, and so on.
You know, listening to you guys talk, I realize that something is missing, and that's the mental health burden. If we're excluding mental health burden for drugs, we're missing a lot, because there isn't as much, it's not zero, but there's not as much of a mental health burden for tobacco and alcohol if we're using that as a model. But if we're looking at drugs, there's a huge mental health burden.
I think that's a really interesting and important point. No question that drugs and mental health problems tend to co-occur. I think the question would be, to what extent are mental health problems driving drug use, as opposed to drug use being attributable to mental health disorders or diagnoses?
But that chicken or the egg argument makes us ignore the problem.
I don't think we... fair point. Yeah, we shouldn't be, you know, sort of consign that to the two hard basket. We need to, you know, think about how we can use those kind of outcomes more effectively to accurately capture the overall.
And I say that coming from the clinical point of view, not from the statistician or public health point of view. I see individual practitioners. It's like, well, I don't know if their cannabis disorder led to their schizophrenia or the other way around. And by that time, it's too late and it doesn't matter. That person is convicted to a life of schizophrenia, where if we intervened early, like we do for tobacco, actually, if we understand that this is a problem early, then you could potentially prevent permanent mental health issues if you don't ignore it early on and say, well, I don't know if they were meant to have this problem.
Yeah, I support that. I agree. Yeah, I think we need evidence to help us to understand the relationship better between mental health problems and substance use disorders. It's certainly something we wouldn't want to overlook.
All right, Connor, this needs to be in the National Drug Control Strategy. You have to add that mental health burden in the issue.
Yeah, it's important. And I think NIDA and the CDC both talk about the mental health harms of marijuana. It's anxiety, depression. On their websites, they point out how it's linked to IQ loss, psychosis, schizophrenia. So,
yeah, that needs to be part of it. The other thing is, okay, coming from tobacco. I have to say this, Dr. Reese, we've like so excited that we banned flavored tobacco. You know, everybody's celebrating and the evil tobacco. We were able to ban the flavored, but we have all sorts of flavors, candies, drinks, sodas for marijuana. Like, why is one okay and the other one is demonized and the other one's celebrated?
Well, I think, you know, we may yet see policies implemented to prevent the sale or the dissemination of flavored cannabis products, but you know, the cannabis regulations have, you know, put in place pretty strong restrictions around the point of sale that weren't historically being imposed around tobacco products. So they're restricted to licensed dispensaries, and people need to be 21 or over to access those outlets and so on. That's you know, that's sort of kept these you know, legalized recreational products out of the hands of children. I'm not going to suggest completely out of the hands, but we sort of made access for children much more difficult than has been the case.
But wait, Dr. Reese, I have to push back on that. The number one cause of pediatric poisonings, age under 5 in the United States, is marijuana. We have completely failed our babies in this country who are getting into their parents' little gummies. And, you know, probably every day, every children's hospital sees a baby who overdosed on marijuana. We've failed on that.
Well, that's you know, we've also seen outcomes that are not dissimilar with respect to nicotine products, and you know, and it's precisely those sorts of outcomes that have been used to advocate for better policies to protect the health of young people. So, you know, so as we generate data that informs policymakers about the risk to very young people, to children and infants, you know, that's going to be very helpful if we want to seriously consider banning cannabis products that are presented in the form of candy or other child appealing.
Yeah, like why other countries don't do this? Why do we need, like, you know, Weedos that look like Cheetos and all these can, like, who is that marketed to?
Well, they're ostensibly marketed to adults, aren't they? But there's appeal that may stretch beyond or to those who are under the age of 21.
We tried in California and failed. Firstly, to put labels on cannabis products in the same science-based fashion that we do for tobacco and for alcohol, and we failed at that. And then the next year, we thought, okay, let's talk about the babies. We have all the data of the pediatric poisonings. Let's, you know, ban the candies, and we failed at that. I tried a bill to put labels on medications, because there is like 300 and 500 different drugs that interact with marijuana. People don't know that if you're on a blood thinner, you shouldn't be taking marijuana. If you're on your blood pressure medicines or depression medicines, those probably interact with marijuana. So we tried to do it like the other way. Go to the pharmacies, and on your prescription, it would say, don't use with cannabis, just like it says, don't use with alcohol or grapefruit juice. We failed at that. And this year, we tried to like get the hemp products that have not been tested on even rats. Our mice are being tested on the human population to get that off the market, and we failed at that. So I don't know, kind of striking out there in California. But we'll keep trying.
It's I think, you know, in terms of regulation of cannabis products, we've got a long way to go. There's it's early days yet, and I think we will see a lot more develop as time goes by and as we generate better evidence.
Well, studying tobacco and alcohol, what do you recommend should be happening with cannabis?
You know, I think on the one hand, they're doing a lot right. You know, making very tight restrictions around point of sale makes sense. I wish we'd had that sort of opportunity to restrict the way in which tobacco products were sold. We need to continue to, you know, inform people about the potential health risks of cannabis use, so people can make, you know, better choices or informed choices. You know, we've seen enormous impact on reducing demand for tobacco products by imposing high levels of excise taxes. We should want to continue to think about ways in which we can reduce demand for cannabis products.
How about potency? You know, remember how tobacco, they try to make it more nicotine content and now the cannabis industry has gone crazy. We've got, you could even buy 90% THC.
There's no question that regulating the product itself may also have important advantages. And, you know, we, I think in the United States, have seen some advantages from moving away from combusted tobacco products to non-combusted, which include vaping products and oral tobacco products. I would recommend those sorts of strategies be favored in cannabis products.
Yeah. Connor, you work for Smart Approaches to Marijuana with Kevin Sabet and Foundations for Drug Policy Solutions. Tell us a little bit about these organizations. Are they a say no to all drugs organizations? What kind of organizations we have? And then we did have a podcast with Kevin Sabet several years ago.
So Kevin, along with former Congressman Patrick Kennedy, started SAM about 10 years ago after Colorado legalized recreational marijuana. Their position is more to like a middle ground. They don't want to legalize and commercialize marijuana, but they also don't want to criminalize it and incarcerate people. Their favored position's more for decriminalization, which would then still discourage use and attempt to promote public health. Then maybe a year or two ago, they launched the Foundation for Drug Policy Solutions, which is then focused on all other drugs, such as opioids and cocaine. And their vision is sort of to make it as a response to the Drug Policy Alliance, and they advocate for a more comprehensive approach that includes prevention, treatment, recovery, supply reduction, criminal justice reform, and then aspects of harm reduction like Narcan and then sterile syringes.
So, Connor, when you say Drug Policy Alliance, that's the organization George Soros funded that promotes drug normalization.
Yeah, their main plan is to sort of normalize drugs. They want a regulated supply, but alternatively, the foundation's approach is more toward preventing and discouraging use, and they favor treatment and prevention and recovery.
And when I was at the United Nations, their motto was, "You have your wine, I have my line." Like, hey, it's okay for you to have a glass of wine. Why can't I have a line of cocaine at dinner as well? So that was eye-opening. Marijuana legalization. Florida, I don't know if you're able to talk to this. Florida has an Amendment 3 that's supposed to legalize marijuana. Maybe people say, hey, it's pretty much legal everywhere else. Why shouldn't it be here? But there's a lot of poison pills in that amendment, such as now being able to, you know, have no smoke-free zone because you could use it anywhere. Are you familiar with that Florida's amendment?
I'm superficially familiar. How does it differ, or how does it substantially differ from other states that have legalized marijuana?
I think it allows. So where places where there's smoking banned for tobacco, that won't be banned because you have the right to use marijuana anywhere.
I see.
Right. And so if I get you, Dr. Reese, you would apply the same rules and regulations that we have now to tobacco as far as, you know, the product itself, the sales, where you can consume. We would just, you know, cut and paste and do that.
It's not quite, but in that style, yeah. I think, you know, I think we've learned many lessons from tobacco control that we could, you know, that would be reasonable to apply it to cannabis within reason. But, you know, you mentioned a few policy strategies, but, you know, but the big one here that I'm interested in is smoke-free laws. And, you know, smoke-free laws were rolled out in the United States in the early 2000s, we saw an enormous shift. You know, they were ostensibly to help to protect workers in public venues from being exposed to secondhand smoke, flight attendants and people like that. But the, you know, one of the big advantages of clean indoor air laws or smoke-free laws has been changing public perceptions, changing social attitudes around tobacco use. And, you know, and we've started to, or some jurisdictions, including other countries, Australia, for example, have introduced laws that ban smoking, not just in children's playgrounds, but other public parks and even public beaches. And, you know, on the one hand, you might say, well, people really aren't getting exposed to very much secondhand smoke outdoors where there's, you know, air movement and, you know, plenty of opportunity to move away from the smoker. But part of the strategy is that we're removing smoking and depictions of smoking from places where children might be present. So we're not giving children, you know, repeated exposure to those kinds of things, and giving, you know, them a chance to grow up in a smoke-free community and enjoy the benefits that, you know, kids in other places might enjoy. I think those sorts of principles could apply equally well to cannabis use in public.
I agree. And we even got rid of tobacco in mental health facilities. That was the last place to go because nicotine actually helps the negative schizophrenic effect that people have. And it does kind of relax you temporarily. It has a lot of other harms. But even in mental health facilities, we have smoke-free zones. And I don't know if you've heard this.
Homeless shelters, prisons, you know, smoke-free laws have become pretty ubiquitous. Yeah.
And what happened? And the world didn't, you know, and the sky didn't fall. There was one study, I don't know if you've seen it, where it was a secondhand smoke study looking at a Marlboro cigarette, a vape, a joint, a bowl. And a joint had 3.5 times more secondhand toxins than a Marlboro cigarette.
Yeah, I'm not sure they were toxins per se, but they were fine respirable particles. So I think very, very fine particles that can be inhaled, which themselves can cause injury. I am familiar, I think, with the study that you're referencing. Yes.
So that'll be interesting for Florida. Like, okay, you got rid of, you know, smoke-free zones, but now you're going to have 3.5 times the burden with your cannabis smoke.
Well, you know, I think we sort of need to sort of think about that a little carefully. I wouldn't get too ahead of ourselves. You know, we know, for example, that the cancer risk profile of exposure to secondhand tobacco smoke is probably very different to cannabis smoking.
But wait, is that really true? Because, you know, there was a recent study now, and we're behind the science. We've allowed cannabis, and then the science is only catching up to the harms. And we're seeing, you know, same amount of ENT cancers now with cannabis users.
If we can attribute it solely to cannabis use, that's certainly concerning. But, you know, but when we look at the emissions from cannabis smoke, I think the concentration and the number of carcinogens is different to tobacco smoke emissions. So, you know, so it's a different mix of.
There was a study of CAT scans of people who smoked marijuana without tobacco and those who smoked tobacco. And the CAT scans of people who smoke marijuana, which makes sense because you inhale much more deeply than the tobacco smokers were worse. Yeah. So.
Well, that's you know, of course, we're talking about sort of direct exposure among consumers of those products in terms of, so I was thinking really about secondhand smoke exposure. I think we you know, important to sort of communicate accurately to the public the risks of exposure to cannabis smoke versus tobacco smoke. I think it's important that we don't sort of get alarmist and say that cannabis smoke is just as harmful or more harmful when we don't have that evidence. But I think we should advance policies that help to protect young people from being exposed to people's drug use in public. If we want to set some sort of social standard or principle, I think that would be a reasonable place to start. It's worked very well with tobacco, and I see no reason why we shouldn't adopt a similar strategy with cannabis. And if that's what the Florida amendment aims to do, or to undermine our ability to restrict public displays of drug use, then that's very disappointing.
Yeah. All right. So, Connor, anything you want to add on that? Is Sam involved in that Florida debate?
Sam is opposing that ballot measure, and their concern is also with bringing in the industry. So once that's ushered in, the campaign is funded, I think, by Trulieve, which has donated about $70 million or more. So then they'll start promoting the product, creating new types of, like, vapes that you mentioned, above 90%, edibles, As use goes up, we've seen that misuse is also followed. Approximately 3 in 10 users now have cannabis use disorder, and they're more daily users of marijuana than daily users of alcohol. Like you said, their additional concerns are related to mental health and impaired driving. But like at a more fundamental level, I think Sam's concern would be that legalization may exacerbate risk factors and then weaken protective factors. So like policies can be changed, but in general, I think we've seen that it increases the availability of marijuana, reduces risk perceptions, and normalizes its use, which then likely helps to explain the rise in use and misuse, at least among adults.
Yeah. I think if Florida wants to legalize marijuana and be like many of the other states, they should learn the lessons, the mistakes from the other states, and not repeat them, and do a better job at regulating, which this bill doesn't do.
And I might suggest keep the industry at arm's length.
Yeah, right. That's right. Asking the fox to guard the hen house. Anything else you guys want to add that we should know about?
Well, for the JAMA article, the proposal was for the Dolly metric to be incorporated as like an overarching goal in the National Drug Control Strategy and then healthy people. But healthy people is only created once about every 10 years, and then the National Drug Control Strategy is once in administration. So before that, we also think it should be added to the Drug Control Data Dashboard, which is maintained by ONDCP. It was mandated by Congress with a few metrics, but the director also has the authority to add anything else that helps to detail progress toward addressing the current goals and then the drug crisis in general. So we think they can easily add the Dolly metric to the dashboard where it would be alongside existing metrics. It wouldn't displace anything, but it would help lend support and credibility to our proposed approach. And then for the incoming administration, they can then hopefully build on that and then incorporate it more formally into their next strategy and framework.
Very interesting. And Dr. Rees?
That was very nicely put, Connor. I think that is a great way to sum it up, actually.
Right. And so what are you guys working on next? What's next for you?
I'm in my last year of the MPH, so after I graduate, ideally I would like to go back to ONDCP, and then until or if that doesn't happen, then I intend to continue working at SAMN and the Foundation for Drug Policy Solutions.
What would you like to do with ONDCP?
When I was an intern, I was with their external and legislative affairs teams, so hopefully back with that team, but on the like nonpartisan career side.
Oh, very nice. Well, good luck to you, Connor. You have everything stacked into your favor. It seems like when you set your mind on something, you figure it out and make it happen.
That's a good example of good ideas having impact for the public good. I think that's really what Connor embodies here.
And how nice to have such a nice mentor, Dr. Rees, that you're able to do for Connor. I'm sure you've done for many students where you see that potential and you let them run and foster it and nourish and guide. That's really, you know, very lucky to have that.
Thank you. But, you know, as you know, it's just it's a pleasure to do this kind of work with smart, engaged people. So.
And I think it's also worth mentioning the article had another co-author, Howard Koh, who was an assistant secretary for health in the Obama administration. So sort of the project was advanced with the three of us.
That's very nice. Yes. Be mindful of all those involved. And Dr. Rees, are you going to, I know you're, you know, heading the Harvard Public School tobacco advocacy and research. Is there such a thing for on the harms of cannabis?
You know, there isn't. I just supervised or supported a doctoral student who graduated just this spring, who was very interested in cannabis policy and applied her experience or knowledge of tobacco control policy, looking at the way in which tobacco retail outlets are distributed in 20 odd states that have legalized cannabis. And, you know, and that kind of research, I think we should and could do more of to help us to think better, using evidence to think about, you know, where cannabis outlets or dispensaries should be located to ensure that there's not an overrepresentation in low-income communities and communities that have historically have been targeted by predatory industries such as tobacco and alcohol retailers. So we will try to do more of that kind of work, absolutely.
Yeah, I see a whole department there. Something there in your future, Connor, if you don't go the legislative right, you could do the academic right. There's definitely that gap.
I should just add, that was Lindsay Kephart who did that excellent work.
Connor, Dr. Reese, thank you so much for your time, your education, your advocacy, and teaching us about the burden of disease as it applies to drugs, not just the overdose number.
Thank you so much for having us. Really enjoyed the discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Drug Free America Foundation. Visit dfaf.org. And ISAIC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, that's IASIC1.org. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.